Welcome to the Ellison Report, our weekly broadcast podcast hybrid journal of politics, policy, and the people. We discuss the issues rather than react to the news here at the home of the past. Now it's ancient history. 2016 Baltimore mayoral debate. Also the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm your host and executive producer, Charles D. Ellison, at the WEAA studios here at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. Senior producer Andre Melton is on the board of tech. I don't know, I call it the board of steel sometimes. Why? It's not really steel. It's just a bunch of wires and buttons. So we'll call it the board of tech from now on, along with associate producer Tyron Rice, ready to offer deep dive public affairs programming from inside Charm City, actually within the Baltimore, D.C. corridor. Find me at Ellison Report on Twitter. 40 years after perceived gains from the civil rights movement, neighborhoods are resegregating. That's the conclusion of a new study conducted by American University sociologist Michael Bader, who examined 1,000 neighborhoods and their levels of diversity in metropolitan areas such as Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, and New York. Why is that happening? How much is it accelerating? What does it bode for our future? And what does it mean politically? Here to discuss that is Professor Bader himself, joining us by phone from Washington. Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So let's talk about the study in general, how you arrived here. What triggered your interest in these trends, and what exactly was your criteria for a resegregated neighborhood?
Yeah, so my interest broadly is in how neighborhoods have changed since the end of the Civil Rights Movement, as you mentioned, or not the end of the Civil Rights Movement, kind of the height of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. And so the Fair Housing Act, which was the last major piece of civil rights legislation under the Johnson administration, passed in 1968. And the Census Bureau collected data on where residents lived in 1970, 2 years later. And so I could follow that data over time. And 10,000 neighborhoods in the New York, Los Angeles, Houston, Chicago metropolitan areas.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what we try to do is to find similarities between those 10,000 neighborhoods based on how many blacks, whites, Latinos, and Asians lived in the neighborhood mm-hmm. in 1970. And then the rate of change of each of those groups within neighborhoods from 1970 to 2010. And this is a little bit different than what other folks who have done similar research, where they've really only looked at whether a particular group is present or not. But, you know, a group might be considered present in a neighborhood. Let's say if there's 80% whites and 20% Latinos, most studies would classify that neighborhood the same way they would a neighborhood that's 20% white and 80% Latino. Mm-hmm. And so what we really wanted to do is try and dig down and see if the rate, how the rates of change were going on. And what we found was a little, on the one hand, a little depressing. There are signs of optimism we can talk about later, but many of the neighborhoods that we see now where multiple groups are living,
right.
A lot of those are, if we look at the rate of change, will have become, have already become, or are becoming resegregated over time. And that was the major conclusion that you mentioned, that it was based on this, on a statistical model that tried to find similarities in these different rates.
Now, let me sort of clarify here, using the term resegregation. So the neighborhoods that you have whites moving into, or that you're describing as whites moving into, they were, in some respects, already kind of segregated, at least in technical terms. They were already segregated in terms of just maybe they had their full black composition or their full Latino composition, and suddenly whites are coming in and they're sort of just making it white segregated all over again.
It's blacks and Latinos and Asians entering formerly all white neighborhoods and it being integrated, looking like it's integrated for many years, but
got
then
it.
Whites don't move in to those neighborhoods, and so what ends up happening is we end up with resegregation rather than an all-white neighborhood. We might end up with an all-black or all-Latino neighborhood.
Okay. And so that, what you call resegregation, is that also kind of what a lot of other observers define or call these days gentrification? I mean, is that sort of the same thing, or is there differences in that?
No, so actually they're different. So one of the kind of trajectories that the statistical model identified was what we would think of as gentrification. So as neighborhoods mm-hmm. where largely Latinos were living, this didn't happen so much in neighborhoods where African Americans were living, but you see whites had been, the percentage of whites had been declining over time and then mm-hmm. increasing. What I'm talking about is actually happening much more in the outer ring, city neighborhoods and the inner ring suburbs.
Right.
So in places like the South Side of Chicago or the North Bronx, or in Newark, what we found was that lots of neighborhoods that had been integrated between whites and blacks in those places are now becoming predominantly black. And in L.A. and Houston in particular, we found a lot of neighborhoods that were integrated between whites and Latinos. They're now almost exclusively Latino.
Hey, are there certain economic policy or political characteristics of a particular metropolitan area of a particular city or suburb that instigate or promulgate that type of resegregation?
So that's what we're looking at next. You've anticipated our next line of research on this. What we wanted to do for this paper was just identify the types of change, and our hope in the coming studies is to look at why they change. I have a guess as to why some of this might happen, and it actually has to do more with whites and what whites do. So whites, basically, it appears, seem to be okay. Many whites seem to be okay with integration as long as it comes to them. So they're fine living in a neighborhood. They don't flee neighborhoods as blacks or Latinos move in. But they're also not probably as open-minded as they might like to think, because when many of them decide to move, they move to neighborhoods that are far more white than the neighborhoods that they left behind. And so what ends up happening then is either blacks or Latinos or Asians end up filling the houses they leave behind, and that leads over the long run, if enough moves happen or if enough deaths to whites happen, the neighborhood will become predominantly non-white.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see that happening in the suburban city where I live, in that neighborhood. You moved there about 10, 11 years ago. Much more racially diverse back then than it is now. But definitely for every white family that's moving out, it's a black family that's moving in.
Yes.
So that's kind of what caught my interest. Kind of on just a personal level, that's what sort of caught my interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of watching this process play out in different places and, mm-hmm. and what was interesting to see. So I originally studied this in Chicago and then expanded the study out to study the other three metropolitan areas, and it was surprising that it happens, at different groups at different times, but in all four of the metropolitan areas that I studied.
So there's like a general statement in your research, and correct me if I'm reaching here, if I'm misinterpreting that general statement, that white people find, I don't know, could you make the statement that white people sort of find, or a lot of white people find, racially diverse neighborhoods unappealing? Or is that the core driver behind this resegregation, or is it the economic factor and also a mix of failed policy? And how can you expect to instigate policy change without some degree of white residential buy-in?
Yeah, that's a lot.
I know,
a couple of hours for me. But but no, so let me try and tackle them one at a time.
Sure, sure.
So I think a large part of this story has to do with whites' residential preferences. And another line of research that I have, I look at where whites would consider moving, even where they know about. So I published a paper with one of my colleagues a couple years ago in which we found mm-hmm. that whites even know less about neighborhoods, like are more likely to not know about neighborhoods the more blacks or Latinos live in them. This was in Chicago. And so if that's the case, then it's hard to see ways in which integration happens if they don't even know about neighborhoods, and once they do know about them, tend not to consider them. And so I think that the policy definitely needs to play a role in future efforts to integrate. And in fact, the Obama administration's Housing and Urban Development has developed a new affirmatively furthering fair housing rule, which that very awkward phrasing comes from the Fair Housing Act itself, in which new grants to public housing authorities are going to require showing that the plan will mitigate racial segregation and economic segregation in the metropolitan area in order for the grants to be approved. Congress, Republican Congress, is trying to stop it right now. I would push Republican Congress not to, but I have zero sway with them. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's an important aspect at the federal level to consider. The other thing based on policy is that what we're talking about now is current segregation patterns. So that doesn't even account for the many historical ways that the federal government and local and state governments failed blacks and Latinos in places before we even started studying this process. So if you look at the south side of Chicago, for example, many parts of Detroit, parts of Baltimore and D.C., that is a historical legacy that's going to be with us for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice any trends where blacks, Latinos, Asians, people of color in general were deliberately resegregating as well? Or maybe they just, you know, sort of just forced into their own segregated neighborhoods because of economic and social mobility factors?
So my own research doesn't say this, but there are some great books. One that your listeners might be interested in is called Blue Chip Black, which is actually about the D.C. area. So mm-hmm. Karen Lacey studies the areas in Prince George's County in Northern Virginia. And basically what she finds is that some African-Americans in particular are really interested in living in all-black neighborhoods. And there's nothing to say that anyone should stop folks from doing that, and these are wealthy black neighborhoods, you know, and she makes sure to study the very wealthy to show that it's not just economics that matter. What I'm more concerned about are folks who move to integrated neighborhoods and are interested in living in integrated neighborhoods, mm-hmm. but if whites don't reciprocate that interest, then the chances of integration go down dramatically.
Got it. Couldn't somebody sort of counter to those arguments, your research, the research of others, that, well, it's not about race, it's about familiarity. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I could kind of go back to high school or college days where a bunch of us black students would sit at the same lunch table and, you know, we get a little grief from white students who were saying we were segregating ourselves. But it wasn't even about race. It was just about familiarity. We grew up in similar neighborhoods. We just kind of gravitated towards who looks like us. And so is it on sort of a base level? Is it something as simple as that?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'd have a job if it was as simple as that.
right. I wanted to try.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I think what you raise, I mean, even the way you phrase the question is really interesting, right? You all lived in the same neighborhood. So mm-hmm. right there, the past
right.
racial segregation matters for who you're familiar with. And
right.
if we don't become familiar with folks who are not, you know, our own race, for me, you know, if I don't get to know people who aren't white, then I'm never going to develop that familiarity, and that's going to be problematic for the country and the economy in the long term.
Right. And so let's talk about that. How does that become, or do you have any thoughts on how problematic that becomes in a political context? I mean, you look at this current election, and there's these brewing racial tensions. There's this really dominant racial narrative in the current 2016 election on both the Democratic and the Republican side. And so how does this resegregation contribute to what's happening on the political stage?
So I actually thought about this mostly in response to the debate between Ta-Nehisi Coates and Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bernie Sanders' campaign really argues about, if we just solved economic consequences, then racial disparities would go down in this country and, you know, things would improve for non-whites. I actually don't entirely buy that argument and fall, I think, much more in line with the argument that Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jamelle Bouie and others were arguing against that line. And here's why, in terms of thinking about it at a residential level. So let's say if you're in D.C. or Baltimore, where whites still make up close to a majority, it's no longer a majority, but they're the plurality of residents in those neighborhoods, I mean, mm-hmm. in those metropolitan areas. If they refuse to consider neighborhoods and they are actively have a stigma against neighborhoods that are integrated or not white, the housing values, the property values in those neighborhoods are going to decline, which means, given how we fund aspects of our government in the United States, including schools and hospitals and police forces, those services are going to decline. And so what that ends up meaning is that even if we had a race-blind policy for helping poverty, mm-hmm. Black neighborhoods, the white integrated neighborhoods and black neighborhoods and Latino neighborhoods that whites avoid are going to continually needing those resources without some kind of race-conscious policy.
Mm, interesting. So I'm curious also, well, one last question here. we see income inequality sort of rising across the board. We see less social mobility for everyone, greater debt, underemployment, wage decreases across the board. Obviously, those issues that I just mentioned, they hit Black and Latino populations much harder. Yet whites are also feeling some of that, too. And I'm curious, what happens when they resegregate and then face those creeping economic pressures? Do they then reintegrate or go back to integration out of necessity? What happens there?
So what's most likely to happen is that the kind of economic troubles that reach whites will make it harder to move. And so, as I mentioned before, as long as neighborhoods are integrating around whites, they'll tend to stay, and so that would exacerbate that process. So it actually make more integration possible because whites will stay where they are. I don't see that the integration or the movement of whites has as much to do with the areas I'm studying. I see that a lot of the problems in wake stagnation and the kind of turn towards awful violent rhetoric in in the current campaign actually revolves a lot around places that are not necessarily in metropolitan areas, but places that have lost large numbers of jobs, places that lost mining jobs and coal jobs and things like that. And so I think that is actually where a lot of the decline in white prosperity is coming, and not so much in metropolitan areas. I think the disparities in metropolitan areas are still much larger than the nation as a whole.
All right. Fascinating research, fascinating insights from Professor Michael Bader, American University. Thanks so much, Professor. I really appreciate it. Where can we catch you on Twitter, by the way?
It's at @Mike_Bader, @Bader.
@Mike_Bader. That's easy.
All right.
Okay. Hey, listen, thanks again. Really appreciate it.
We'll
be back
you.
In touch.
Pleasure to talk to you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
We'll be right back with Jedediah Brown, organizer of that Trump rally counter protest in Chicago we've been hearing so much about, at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
We got Miss Astrid. Telling you what you need to do.
Get up in the morning.
Hey, gotta get on up.
The Ellison Report is made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility. More at onenessmobility.com. And with support from BE Strategy. More at strategybe.com. As Trump rallies get bigger and more frequent, with the complexion of the audiences largely white and visibly angry, so now are the protests against them. Such was the case in the past week in places like Chicago, Cincinnati, and St. Louis, where anti-Trump organizers, exasperated by the Republican presidential candidate's racial dog whistle politics, converged on these rallies in a show of open political protest unseen in recent years, with pressure so bad in Chicago that it shut a massive Trump rally down and ended in reported violence. Talking with us about that and more is Chicago pastor and activist Jedediah Brown, the organizer behind that Trump rally counter-protest and a surrogate on the Bernie Sanders campaign trail. Welcome, Pastor. How are you doing, sir?
Hello, sir. Glad to be on your show.
All right. Thanks for being here. Okay, so clarify for us quick. You were the main organizer behind what we saw unfolding in Chicago last weekend, so their reports are sometimes spotty on that. At one point, it was MoveOn.org. And then it was Black Lives Matter taking partial credit, and then it's Trump blaming the Sanders campaign. So I just real quick, curious as to who organized it and why this rally at that time.
So this is, I'm glad I get to clear up some things. Number one, I'm a very well-known activist in Chicago because I take up many issues. And activism community is not that large. It's actually growing, especially now. Mm. But I went to that rally as an individual, but obviously engaged in conversations with activists across the city and aware of an overwhelming desire to shut it down. Mm-hmm. So no one entity could be accredited for organizing. It wasn't even necessarily an organized effort. It was the heartbeat of a city.
Got it. And that mainstream media portrait that you're seeing these days, and obviously the Trump campaign's assertion that's all over the airwaves, is that anti-Trump protesters like yourself sparked the violence. You refute that, of course, obviously.
That the protesters sparked the violence?
Right, right. You know, there's sort of this narrative that obviously Trump trying to put out there, mainstream media, certain folks are putting out there that you sparked the violence, or the anti-Trump protesters sparked the violence. But that didn't happen. You refute that?
The protesters show extremely great restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to a point where we had to defend ourselves. And it is unfortunate that it is being spent that we were a violent group. But it was very much so a very contentious and racially charged, dangerous atmosphere for the protesters since the beginning, but even before they were identified as protesters.
Mm. And so what's the larger issue or concern for you? What does Trump personify for you? What sort of fire is he playing with?
The rallies of Donald Trump, what does it personify? It personifies everything that's wrong with America. Because what it is doing is it's what's wrong with America, but it's also exposing what we knew was here and is still here and now is coming out. Because you have such hatred and such ignorance and such bigotry that comes out of the people who are supporting Donald Trump, that they're delusional, that in a sense that they're saying let's get jobs and make America great, but they don't realize they're exposing that what they mean by that is they want it to go back to the 60-era kind of activity in America.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
You have an individual who I am extremely shocked and appalled, Donald Trump being able to run a successful campaign in 2016 like this, of this magnitude and nature, and have this kind of following, tells you exactly the character that America has still not moved away from and still needs to address.
And so how do you talk to those supporters? Do you feel like in some way or in some level, you know, you got this, you know, fairly obnoxious billionaire reality show mogul? Do you feel like in some way they've been bamboozled in a way? You know, do you sort of feel like on a level maybe, you know, you can also kind of talk to them to try to snap them out of it, so to speak? Or do you think that just the anger and the hatred is so far ahead, they're at a point of no return, the Trump supporters?
Bamboozled, no. Exposed, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what has happened is, and now after Barack Obama has become president, we now see what people really feel. We see what they really mean. This literally, I'm going to tell you from what I felt in that arena, I felt like the people, because I identified some of those individuals. I spend every day of my life trying to be harmonious and walk in love, and I appreciate differences. I'm not intimidated by them. So I've gone to a lot of places where I've seen a lot of Caucasian counterparts, and I interact with them. And I was so shocked to see people who are professionals who, in the daytime, I think live a respectable, seemingly respectable life, but I ended up catching them yell racial slurs and spewing bigotry and operating in ignorance. Mm. And it felt like Klansmen who in the day are your professionals, your police, your doctors, and in the night put the hood on their head to show what they really feel, who they really are at the core. And that's what's happened. They're not bamboozled. They just felt they found a safe environment to be them, but in retrospect, they're just exposed.
You know, I'm real curious, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are curious out there. So you actually had people, white people, Trump supporters, throwing racial epithets at you, like calling you like slurs, like the N-word, other types of words. Is that the case? Is that what was happening in Chicago?
Absolutely. Before the uproar and the chaotic scene that you see in the media, it was being done, but in somewhat seemingly, I guess, a joking manner. I think they thought it was fun. It was sport. Just fun sport for them. But once the rally was canceled, they became extremely hostile and aggressive. But I remember when I first got in the facility, I stood in the concession line. A brother was hungry. I wanted to eat. When I was standing inside the concession line, I'm never going to forget the Caucasian males who came and asked me, who said to me, you must be buying your food with welfare. And they thought it was funny. They walked away from it. And I couldn't believe it. And I watched Muslims attacked for praying. I watched women that were Hispanic attacked. And not only that, I heard countless times them telling other blacks to go back to Africa, saying that Trump would build a wall. But it was something that they done in fun. They thought that it was okay to do it, which let me know that Donald Trump has fostered an environment. His rhetoric and his presentation has allowed people to think that it is okay in the name of saying, in the name, I guess, of or whatever it is, that he made people think it's okay to be this way. And so they're doing it.
And let me ask, because I'm just kind of getting a sense of that right now. I've never been to a Trump rally.
I don't want to go.
Right. I'm not going to deny that either. But, much respect to you for that kind of bravery to go to win as well. But I have to ask. So were they making any distinction between black and brown protesters and anti-Trump protesters? And maybe black and brown, a few black and brown people, I'm not saying there's a whole bunch, but maybe a few black and brown people that were actually going there supporting Trump, were they making any kind of distinction, or was it indiscriminate? Just any black or brown face they see, they just started hurling these insults at you.
Man, nobody's going to believe this. I'm telling you, bro. If they didn't have a Make America Great red hat on or a Trump sign in their hand, and if they wasn't white, they were the enemy. And there were a few. There were like a couple black people who I saw that they utilized that were actually supporters of Trump, and they would come literally and stand against the people of color, different backgrounds, and the white people would kind of sort of get behind that one black person, and they would push them and egg them on to confront the protesters. And this was the weirdest experience of my life. I felt like I was walking through a history book, captivated in the 60s. No lie, no joke.
Should we even saw
that same black guy. That's another thing. You saw something on my mind. I remember even seeing that same black guy who was one of the, because it was like it was a couple, but it was this one particular. He was a really buff guy, and he was standing against the protesters. And then eventually, when the chaos happened, I remember seeing white people screaming in his face, "Go back to Africa, you N-word." It was the craziest thing.
So that might seem a bit surreal to some folks who are listening. Especially it happens the day after he gets an endorsement from a retired black neurosurgeon. His national spokeswoman is a black woman, Katrina Pearson. And so that might seem surreal on some levels. But I have to ask, should we expect more counter protest or demonstrations like this? I mean, is this something that is going to be ongoing? I mean, not just in Chicago, but elsewhere. And here's a second question. Do you worry that these counter protests at Trump rallies can actually give white Republican voters and maybe white independents in the general election too an excuse to coalesce around Trump?
America has to really, America's getting an opportunity to look in the mirror and see yourself. The first part of your question, I want to say that I can only speak for me and Chicago as much as I'm able to organize. Now that I know for sure, I went into that rally listening and hearing, trying to figure out if it was really the environment that the media portrayed. I wanted to give it a fair chance because I know how the media can take a sound bite and create a narrative. I wanted to know for myself, especially after seeing a young black man who was peaceful, punched in the face, and then a gentleman coming behind him and saying, maybe next time we'll have to take his life. I was concerned. And so being there and seeing it, experiencing it, feeling it, and now being recognized for having been there and stood and standing against it, it is no question. And actually, I applaud the cities behind us because there have been others who have gone against Trump's protests in Chicago has taken that stand, and I applaud them for that. This is a campaign that cannot go unchallenged at this particular point. It has to be a campaign that we stand against, not because of just political views, not because of who's going to be the victim and who's going to be the aggressor, but because of American values. We're in a values fight now. And beyond that, so if we stay silent, we consent. And we can't stay silent because we see the environment that a Donald Trump's presidency would create. And we can't get there and then say, oh, man, we're in trouble. We got to stop it before we get there. The global community is watching America, and the global community is beckoning us to stand up against us going backwards as a country. Mm-hmm. And then the last part of your question, you're saying, you're asking me, it just slipped my mind. Could you repeat that last part of your question?
You know, are you worried that that these counter protests at Trump rallies, the anti-Trump protests, could give white Republican voters, maybe white independents in the general election too, an excuse to coalesce around Trump to empathize with him?
So we have, you have a lot of vocal people. My Twitter page has not stopped. My Twitter feed has not stopped moving since I've done that particular rally. But what I'm happy to report to you is that I've gotten an overwhelming amount of support that continues to come in. And one of the things that Trump's campaigns talk about is this seemingly silent majority. Well, the people who are for Trump may be loud, but the people who are the reasonable, the people who are the loving, the people who are the focus, who want a America that really is great in the sense that it loves and works for everybody, those are the silent majority. And they have sent so many messages of support, even the Republicans. I've gotten a large number of Republicans who are now pausing to say, wait a minute, this could not be about being committed to a party if it's going to them seeing that level of chaos at their rally made them pause. And there was even these presidential candidates who are now going back and endorsing Donald Trump. They know, they've even talked about the things he's done. I'm very disappointed in the Republican Party for not taking a stance against the rhetoric of this campaign before it became the leading force on the Republican Party.
Pastor Brown, I'm going to cut you off too. I got you maybe for another 30 seconds, but one other question I have for you, real important question.
I'm sorry, I'm having a conversation.
No, it's okay, and it's good. I appreciate it too. I like the flow. But is what you're organizing, is that going to mobilize or translate into votes in the general election, you think? Is fear or anger at Trump and his supporters, can that galvanize voters? Is that something that can mobilize voters into coming out, into turning out during the election, in the general election in November?
I'm not going to respond to hate with hatred. We're going to respond to it with love. Love never fails. That is the ultimate goal, to get our people educated and inspired and woken enough to actually reach the polls that Donald Trump will never become the president of the free world. Mm-hmm. And we're going to also utilize our global community to make sure we deliver that result. You see it now in Chicago. We worked very hard after the Laquan McDonald video. Mm-hmm. And watch, I believe that there will be a new state's attorney in Cook County, and that's going to be Kim Fox, because we're voting. We're getting it.
All right. All right. Many thanks, Pastor Jedediah Brown. He's the organizer. He's a longtime community organizer in Chicago. He organized that anti-Trump rally that we saw over the past weekend. Pastor, thanks so much for coming on. Keep us updated.
Honored. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. After the break, it's Cato Institute's Emily Eakins on whatever happened to the Tea Party. Here at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. She can't so walk in the dark. Guess who walking bird dog? If you don't know how to do it, and we're back at Yellowstone Report, made possible by support from Oneness Mobility. More at onenessmobility.com, and from partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications. More at strategybe.com. In discussions on Donald Trump and the expected full implosion of the Republican Party, there's a constant question wondered out loud by many observers of the 2016 election. What happened to the Tea Party? That insurgent political movement that took the 2010 congressional midterms by storm seems like a distant memory, hear it from some. But did it ever go anywhere, or are we seeing flashes of Tea Party 2.0? Here to explain that is Emily Eakins, a senior research fellow at the Cato Institute, cato.org, for more information. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's just kind of high-level conversation here to start. So what did happen to the Tea Party? Is the rise of Donald Trump a metastasized manifestation of that?
I would have to say the answer to that is no. Donald Trump is actually not Tea Party. There is definitely some overlap, but when you think about it, right now, two of the top three contenders for the Republican nomination were propelled into their current positions by the Tea Party movement, and that's not Donald Trump, that's Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio.
Exactly. Right.
They were both elected to the Senate in 2010 and 2012 against, you know, so-called establishment favorites. They were the underdogs, and they kind of won in a kind of a surprise victory because of the Tea Party grassroots. And in fact, they're the ones that are kind of in opposition in many ways to Donald Trump. But, like I said, there is some overlap between the Tea Party movement and Donald Trump, but really, he has activated a brand new set of voters, people that have not voted in Republican primaries for at least a while. So we're seeing a new phenomenon with Donald Trump.
Well, okay, so he's, and not to spend too much time on Donald Trump, but obviously a lot of folks kind of honed in on him and focused on him, and there's this sort of assumption that he's playing to that. You know, he did get a rather prominent Tea Partier from Texas as his national spokeswoman, a former congressional candidate,
yeah.
Katrina Pearson. So, you know, some people just assuming that. But so he's sort of activating or mobilizing Republican voters, especially in a way that the Tea Party didn't.
That's true. When you think, if you look at what Donald Trump, what's driving his support, if you look at public polling, the number one predictor, you know, statistical modeling that predicts voting for Donald Trump, attitudes on immigration are the strongest predictor for attitudes towards Donald Trump. Well, I've actually run some similar models for the Tea Party movement back in 2010 and 2012. Immigration is actually not the strongest predictor of being a Tea Party supporter. Instead, it was attitudes about limited government, people who wanted a small central government, less spending, taxes. That was the strongest predictor of being a Tea Party supporter. Now, that's not to say that there aren't other things that matter and that could draw someone to the Tea Party movement or to Donald Trump, like you said. Katrina Pearson, the spokeswoman for the Donald Trump campaign, actually, she herself was a Tea Party leader in Texas. So there's definitely some overlap, but really the thing that really draws the central impulse of the Donald Trump campaign is immigration. The central impulse of the Tea Party movement was actually the size and scope of government.
And so it never really went anywhere, now, did it? One thing I've always noticed over the last few years is that support levels for the Tea Party do remain somewhat constant between sort of that 25% to 30% zone when you look at many polls. Is that what you find as well?
Yes, that's correct. So they didn't really go anywhere. Now, they're not protesting. The people that you saw on your TV screens that were protesting or organizing meetings, there's less of that. There's fewer people attending meetings. There's less protesting. But those people didn't go anywhere, and their minds didn't change. They didn't become, you know, less supportive of limited government than they were before. They're just not they're not protesting in that active way. But like I mentioned, when you think about it, right now there are three people that are like the top contenders for the Republican nomination for president. Two of them literally would not be here today if it were not for the Tea Party movement. That's Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. Right now, if it weren't for the Tea Party, Ted Cruz would still be, you know, like the state solicitor general back in Texas. Marco Rubio might be in the legislature. They would not be in a position to run for president coming from the Senate if it weren't for the Tea Party back in 2010 and 2012.
Are there still elements of the Tea Party that are sort of behind the scenes helping either two of those candidates?
I think that there are, actually. I think that Ted Cruz, one of the reasons, when you think about it, he's actually won. So it's Donald Trump has amassed the most delegates, but, you know, not far behind him is Ted Cruz. So he's won maybe 7 or 8 states thus far, and he surprised people. Ted Cruz surprised people by winning in Iowa. Oh, how did he do that? Well, he does really well in caucus states, and one of the reasons I think he's doing well in caucus states is because of those grassroots networks. Now, think about it. Back in 2010 and 2012, there were all these Tea Party groups that were very active, and they had long email lists of people in their own communities, in their neighborhoods, and maybe they protested together once, but they probably formed a little Tea Party group, and they have all these email addresses. So when Ted Cruz comes to town or there's an election coming up, they have a way to activate people that the other candidates don't have in the same way. So Donald Trump comes to town, there's a big rally, there's tons of news coverage. Well, that gets his supporters excited. For Ted Cruz, he has access to these grassroots activists, these Tea Party networks at a local level that are harder to see, but they exist. I mean, they're the reasons why he got elected. Marco Rubio has some access to that, but it seems like Tea Party folks disproportionately support Ted Cruz.
It's interesting because with Ted Cruz, there is a narrative of his gathering strength from evangelical voters. So real quick, Emily, explain to me, is there any sort of intersection or any sort of interface between those Tea Party elements and those evangelicals? Any sort of mix that's going on there?
Absolutely. There is a big overlap. In my research of the Tea Party movement, it became very clear early on that there was at least two halves of the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. And one half was this kind of evangelical half. The other half was a little bit more socially moderate, not that concerned about same-sex marriage or abortion. The other half was. They were all very similar when it came to taxes and spending and limited government, but they were, you know, there was this evangelical half. Mm-hmm. And Ted Cruz has really galvanized them. And also evangelicals who weren't really associated with the Tea Party movement. So, and we've heard Ted Cruz say this, he has this strategy of bringing back together the libertarians, the evangelicals, and the Reagan Democrats. And we've seen that by him trying to bring together the Tea Party and evangelicals and tap into, you know, he actually has overlapping support with some Donald Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. Those are the Reagan Democrats. And so we've seen him make that, that's part of his strategy. We have yet to see if it's going to work.
Got it. Got it. And so can we also say that this is somewhat of a, I don't know, racially pluralistic or cultural group movement? Its ranks are overwhelmingly white. You know, obviously Katrina Pearson, former Tea Party who ran for Congress, she's African-American. And so that has to say something about its roots, right? Its rhetoric and sort of its aggressive resentment of the Obama administration. At least that's what a lot of observers say. Where's sort of the racial linkage there?
So many people have said that the Tea Party movement was not really about limited government, but it was really about racial animus. Mm-hmm. So I've actually investigated this question. Mm-hmm. And the truth is the central impulse of the Tea Party actually is about limited government. However, mm-hmm. there is a part of the Tea Party that also seems to harbor racial resentment towards people of color, and that's some of them. But not all of them, not even close to a majority. So there's some of that. And it's, you know, it's, I guess, perhaps not surprising that you kind of have them glom on. You have people glomming on to the same movement, but for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So, like you said, there actually is, you know, there is diversity within the straight movement, but it's just far less diverse than is the nation overall. That does not seem to be driven by racial animus, but there are some people that glommed on that do on measures of racial resentment that academics use tend to score higher on those measures.
Mm-hmm. And also, would you find it surprising, I mean, or not surprising at all, that sort of this Tea Party movement, this insurgency that we saw happen, especially we saw it spark in the 2010 congressional midterms, was that a result of economic pressure? So, you know, you're saying that the root cause of or the root trigger for Tea Party support is limited government, but maybe it was also just resentment towards government's response to the recession. Do you find a bit of that as well?
You're absolutely right. The Tea Party, the first catalyst for the Tea Party was the bailouts of the banks, the financial institutions and the automakers, which occurred, as you know, under a Republican president. President George W. Bush said we have to abandon free market principles in order to save the free market, and therefore bailing out the banks. That is actually the primary catalyst, and you just hit the nail on the head. Their concern was government's handling of the financial crisis, bailing out the banks, bailing out the automakers, then the stimulus, then bailing out homeowners, and then the health care law, which many of those viewed it as a way for government to take over the healthcare industry. That's how they perceived it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't trust government to run things, if you feel like government's unaccountable, you can understand why you'd be pretty alarmed about the government running healthcare. So all those things just kind of snowballed with the recession into fomenting this movement. But what's interesting is that Donald Trump, he's almost a new phenomenon. I think Donald Trump would exist today regardless of the Tea Party movement. I mean, he was part of the birther movement early on, questioning President Obama's place of birth, you know, suggesting that he wasn't a true American and therefore not eligible to be president. That was going on separate from all of this. Donald Trump was the leader of that, and I think he would try to run for president today regardless of what happened to the Tea Party. And as ironic as some people might find it, the only candidate that is in a position to defeat Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, actually came from the grassroots movement of the Tea Party.
All right. Thank you. Emily Eakin, she's research fellow at the Cato Institute. Emily, I wish I had more time to talk with you. I had a bunch of other questions, but we'll have you back on. I really appreciate the insights.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. The Ellison Report is made possible by support from Oneness Mobility. More at onenessmobility.com. And for partners like BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications, more at strategybe.com. Coming up next, Stefan Henkin, founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies. We are going to do that in a moment here on at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Discuss the latest trends in the Democratic and Republican primaries is Stefan Henkin, founder and president of Lincoln Park Strategies, more at LP Strategies. Good to have you back on, Stefan. How's everything going?
Great, and thanks for having me on again.
All right. So there was a time when we were talking about Donald Trump hitting ceilings, and you're finding a rejection index, as your research calls it, high enough to at some point count him out, maybe. But that didn't happen. He's done well for himself in another battery of Tuesday contests, and so we're pretty much seeing the Republican nominee here. Is that what we should just accept?
I think so. I mean, there's still a decent chance he won't hit the majority of delegates before the convention, although I can't imagine he won't have a plurality going in, and then the question becomes, you know, is the Republican Party willing to blow itself up and nominate someone else, or are they just going to stick with him? And it'll be interesting to watch.
You know, something I found curious in your latest piece on campaigns and elections, and looking at that rejection index once again, his rejection index numbers, well, first I want you to explain what the rejection index is to the audience, but two, explain why his rejection index numbers seem lower than folks like Ted Cruz or Ohio Governor John Kasich?
Yeah, so the rejection, we have two ways of looking at support for voters. It's a rejection index and a commitment index. The rejection index are people who pretty much are just not going to vote for that person, almost regardless of what they do. And then the commitment index is the reverse, people who are pretty much, it would be very hard to get them not to vote for this person. And, you know, and Trump has been, I'll say, defying logic from day one, where, you know, I think everyone and, you know, and certainly, you know, we had our moments, we're expecting the sort of the flash in the pan, similar to what we saw with a handful of candidates this year. We saw this in 2012. But, you know, what seems to be really happening with what's happening with Trump is that he's pulling in voters from across the Republican spectrum, which is not, I think, what was the expected way that this was going to happen for most folks when looking at the data. So what we're seeing on the rejection index is, you know, he's generally within the pack on the commitment side. So, you know, and when we see this where he hasn't won a majority of voters in any state yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the rejection side, like, you know, even though, you know, and I think for Democrats, this is like just incredibly shocking. But, you know, even though all the things he says, like, Republicans are still not willing to completely count him out. Although, you know, I think people are starting to, even on the Republican side, are tiring of the rhetoric. And now what we're seeing, you know, what happened in Chicago and things like that. So, you know, in national polls, when they do the matchup against Hillary Clinton, Trump's at an average of 38 in the polls. So he's not exactly you know, beloved by any stretch, but he's certainly tapping into, I'll say, a thinking that is out there on the Republican side. But again, you know, to not just lump all Republicans together. You know, he is yet to win a majority in any state. So he's certainly not speaking for Republicans at large, but he does look like the odds-on favorite to be their standard bearer this November.
And so all signs show GOP voters on some level, whether they like it or not, coalescing around Trump. Is that a fair characterization? And that defies notions of a contested or brokered convention, you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I mean, certainly, I believe the far right, you know, comes on board. You know, the Ted Cruz voters, the more called Tea Party type of voter. You know, the evangelicals, I think, get on board just because they're not going to be voting for Clinton. And I think the one cohort within the Republican Party that becomes the interesting question is the more establishment, the more country club Republican, whatever you want to call them. What do they do? And my general sense from focus groups we conducted, what we're seeing in the data is you're going to have a decent amount of people in that group not admit to their friends and family, won't say it out loud, but they're either going to stay home or they're going to vote for Clinton and never speak of it again when they go into the voting booth, just because they look at a Donald Trump and they just like, look, this is just, regardless of what I think about Clinton and some of her policies, that having a Trump presidency is not going to be good for business, is not going to be good for this country, and we just can't have that. And I think that's why we're seeing this lag in the polls where, for the most part, any other candidate, Clinton is pretty close to tied, which is what we would expect to see in polling, just how divided the country is. But if Clinton's up at, 51% and with Trump at 38 in the average of the national polls, and that's a huge gap considering where the country really is when it comes to their politics.
Got it. And I want to also look at the Democratic side of things, Stefan. And how the Sanders insurgency impacts whomever will be the Democratic nominee. We presume it'll be Hillary Clinton. But what do those index numbers look like for Sanders and Clinton? And what do they mean in the general election?
Yeah, so, I mean, we view this the same as you said. I mean, Clinton has the advantage. She has the lead in the delegates, even when we take away the superdelegates. And Sanders is going to have to he's going to have to completely change the dynamic. He can't just be winning a state here and there, even if it's a big state like Michigan and states of that size. But he needs to be winning 60%, 65% to start getting enough delegates to start cutting into her lead. And he's just not doing that yet. And he's going to have to do that in order to have a chance of becoming the nominee. But, what we're seeing is, certainly – Sanders is again, he's speaking to a portion of the Democratic coalition. Mm-hmm. He has a message that is resonating with a good chunk of voters, especially younger voters. And and now it's going to sort of depend on what happens after the primary. Now, what I would hope to see, what I expect to see, is similar to what we saw in 2008. Mm-hmm. There's always the licking of the wounds when your candidate loses, right. But for any Democrat who is a Sanders supporter to then say, I don't care if it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, it doesn't matter to me, or they're one and the same, or whatever the logic is. I mean, is just a little, I would call it outrageous that anyone would even think that way. So, I would expect to see what we saw in 2008, that most of the Clinton supporters, it took a couple weeks to kind of get over it, and then they were on board. Maybe not to the fullest extent as right. The original Obama supporters were, but it's not that they're going to go vote for someone else or, stay home for the vast majority of them.
And so should we ignore that conventional wisdom regarding enthusiasm gaps between the two parties? The conversation now is that Democrats lack enthusiasm, even when they may have higher registration numbers. So is that true, or is it just confined to the primary?
Yeah, it's just confined to the primaries. I mean, there's really, looking back over the years, there's no correlation between turnout in the primaries and what happens in the general election. And
got it.
From what
mm-hmm.
we've seen in the general election for presidential years, I mean, it's a steady pattern. The only blip was in 92 when Ross Perot was running that sort of had defied the patterns a little bit. But, it's been a steady you know, steady movement. You know, we see white voters becoming a smaller and smaller portion of the overall electorate. We see minority voters moving up. We see, you know, the numbers rising, you know, pretty consistently. 08 was a blip in terms of the overall turnout. And 2012 kind of came back to where we would expect it to be. But it would be shocking to see anything really out of the realm of anything different happening in 2016 that's outside of the pattern that we've seen going back to basically 1976.
All right. Stephan Hankin, he's founder and CEO of Lincoln Park Strategies. Stephan, I got to have you back on more often. I really appreciate
it. Happy to come back anytime.
Yeah, I appreciate the analysis, man. I love every now and then reading your pieces in Campaigns and Elections magazine. You should check them out at campaignsandelections.com. Also at LP Strategies on Twitter. Thanks a lot, Stephan.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That wraps this week's edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Go to ellisonreport.com for more information. This was made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, more at OnenessMobility.com, and with support from BE Strategy, more at StrategyBE.com. Touch base with us at Ellison Report on Twitter. Continue to listen in at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Whenever you close your eyes, so many things there to keep you down. No matter you try, can't seem to get it right. Seems like there is no one else around. Wipe the tears from your eyes. Got to trust that you will.